Hello and welcome to Talking Aussie Books, a weekly podcast bringing readers and writers of Australian fiction together. I'm Claudine Tennellis. As an avid reader and passionate advocate for Australian fiction, I make it my mission to spotlight local talent. So if you're looking for your next read or simply want to learn more about the Australian literary scene, this podcast is for you. Grab yourself a cuppa, sit back and relax. I've interviewed so many authors for this podcast now, some I've known and admired for many years before interviewing them, and others I've become acquainted with more recently. However, it's always a particular pleasure to interview a writer that I not only admire on a professional level, but one that I also happen to enjoy a friendship with. And that is especially true of my next guest, Cassie Hamer. Cassie, as many of you will already know, is a dear friend of mine and a fellow member of the Northern Beaches Readers Festival Committee. But more importantly, Cassie is one of Australia's best-selling authors. With three published novels to her name now, she is fast cementing her reputation as an auto-buy author for many readers across Australia. Cassie's new book, with the most fabulous title ever, is called The Truth About Faking It. Published by Harlequin, it's due to be released on the 4th of May. And having had the pleasure of reading an early copy, I can say with absolute confidence that this is Cassie's best book yet. And I'm delighted to have the chance to speak with Cass on the podcast once more. Welcome back, Cass.
Oh my goodness, Claudine, I've just had about 50 different emotions hearing that introduction. Like, I actually feel quite teary, but mostly because of the beautiful friendship that we've developed as a result of this podcast. And you know that I'm a huge fan of your work and what you do and the contribution that you make to the writing community, which is unpaid, but is a hell of a lot of work. So it really is just a total privilege for me to be sitting here today. You always ask the best questions.
Oh, thank you, Cass. And talk about getting teary, my goodness.
Bad start.
Now, it's been a while between books for you, hasn't it? I mean, the pandemic hit many authors hard on so many levels, but for you it meant that the publication of this book was delayed by a year or so. So I guess you must be feeling extra elated that it's about to go into the world.
Elated and freaking out because, yes, my last book, The End of Cuthbert Close, came out in the middle of March 2020. And that was the same week that the whole of Australia went into a six-week lockdown. So there was my brand new book sitting in the shops, but all the shops were closed. And I found that to be a really bruising and difficult experience. I mean, my issue with the book seemed minor in comparison to this global disaster that we were facing. But on a personal level, it was difficult. So, you know, there were times that I wondered if I would ever have another book out there again. So I do feel particularly grateful that The Truth About Faking It is about to come into the world again. But I do feel nervous because it still feels like the tentacles of the pandemic are still there. So definitely lots of mixed emotions, but mostly gratitude.
Was this book already with your publisher before the decision to delay publication was made, or had you yet to finish it?
No, I wrote this book in 2019 and submitted it in March 2020, just as the pandemic was taking off. So it was all written a few years ago now. So it's interesting to try and cast my mind back to that time and to think about what it was like, because the experience of writing in 2019 was just completely different to what it's like trying to write a book now. In a way, 2019 was the free period that we didn't realize was the paradise that we were living in. So in a way, writing this was a dreamy experience because I think, as many authors have found, the pandemic was quite crippling to creativity. I was daily checking case numbers and tuning into the premier's 11 a.m. press conference when really I should have been trying to write a book. But when you have such a huge distraction, there's only so much space in your brain. And I would say 90% of the space in my brain was being taken up with coronavirus, which left very little room for creativity.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about that towards the end of this interview. But for now, I wanted to focus on the title of the book, which I absolutely love. And the cover is just so on point. It's just perfect for the tone of this story. But what I really want to know is whether this was the title of the book that you came up with, or did it come later?
It came later. This book, for a long time in my head, was called Out of the Ashes because it relates to a mysterious death. And so the reference to ashes, and there's a sort of slightly comical slash tragic scene in the book where three women from the one family are scattering ashes and things just go completely awry. So, yeah, for a long time it was called in my head, Out of the Ashes. And then I started thinking that's not quite right. That was too serious a title for what the book is. Not that the book is complete comedy. There's definitely some darker themes, but I needed something that reflected the lightness of it as well and the theme, I suppose. So from Out of the Ashes, I thought for a while, oh, maybe I'll call it The Trainer Women because it is about three generations of women from the same family. But I still wasn't quite happy with that. And the publisher came back to me and just asked me to brainstorm some titles. And she wanted a title that was going to be conversational. There has been sort of a trend or a niche, I would say, in the last couple of years towards titles that sound a bit like part of a sentence or part of a conversation. So I started brainstorming around that, and it was a really helpful process, actually, because the idea of faking it and of women not being true to themselves is essentially what the book is about. But I also like the double play on words in relation to faking it and the connotations that we have around sort of, it's a little bit saucy, I suppose. Yeah. So that was one of the titles that I came up with, and that was the one that the publisher chose.
Yeah. Absolutely loved it. Okay, so for those who haven't read this book yet, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the story.
Sure. So as I mentioned, it is a family drama that focuses on three generations of women from the same family. And it's also about a mysterious death that throws their already slightly complicated lives into complete disarray. So there's Ellen, who's the matriarch, and she's 69, and she is fabulous, or at least she thinks she's fabulous. Ellen thinks she's the star of the Ellen Show and that the world revolves around her. But she's incredibly miffed when she is in life drawing and two policemen come to the door. And they tell her that her husband, or estranged husband, David, has died in a mysterious Thai boating accident. And Ellen is cross. I mean, these guys have interrupted her life drawing. And she's, of course, in denial about her true feelings. But the next thing she does is that she calls her daughter Natasha, who's 48, and she is a high-profile current affairs news presenter, and she's quite the direct opposite to Ellen. She's very straight, very controlled. She finds out this news about her dad just minutes before she's about to go on air, and this very controlled woman completely goes to pieces on air. And look, her career's a little bit on the skids already, so this is like it's going to be another nail in the coffin. And then there's Natasha's daughter, Georgie, who's a 22-year-old, and she works as a producer on a reality dating show, which is very similar to The Bachelor. But in this world, it's called The Single Gal. And she doesn't believe in love. She works on a show that's all about finding true love, but doesn't believe in it for herself. So she's also going to go on a journey towards understanding that you don't have to deny your true feelings.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, there's just so much fodder for discussion just in that, you know, pricey that you've offered us there. But what I really loved about this book as well is that despite the lighthearted, you know, nature and tone of the book, I think there's so many themes and issues in it that I was, you know, really fascinated by. But more particularly, I was interested to know what the initial inspiration for the story was.
So there were a few different inspiration points. Probably one of the main ones was that I knew I wanted to write a book that featured a journalist. So I worked in TV news when I was in my 20s, and it was a tough environment. I was a, girl from a Catholic school and thrust into this very cutthroat, egotistical world. And while I loved it, I also found it incredibly challenging. And at the time, I probably didn't quite appreciate just how sexist the environment was. But as now a woman of, middle-aged years, I feel like I have a much more clear-eyed view about the media, and there were certain things I wanted to say about the treatment of women in the media.
Yeah.
The other inspiration, there are so many different inspiration points for this. With the character of Ellen, I wanted to talk a little bit about financial insecurity for women of a certain age. It's hopefully fairly well known that older women are the fastest growing group of homeless in our society. Women like Ellen, who've been faithful wives, stay-at-home mothers, suddenly find themselves in their late 60s or 70s, perhaps divorced, and with very little superannuation because they haven't had that opportunity to work, and at a real, financial peril. So that was also something I wanted to talk about. I was also deeply inspired by Grace Tame and her movement to allow sexual abuse survivors to tell their own story. And I suppose if there's one big takeaway from this book is that women need to speak up and we need to own our own stories and we need to not be afraid to share our true feelings and experiences, however uncomfortable that may be for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk a little bit more about that too as the interview progresses. But Cass, what I wanted to say was that what I love about your books and your writing is your ability to balance the light and the dark in terms of issues that you tackle. And as you've just described, there are some really dense and topical issues that you've tackled in this book. But you've done this, in a lighthearted way, and you've also used an incredible amount of humour. So I wanted to ask you, that dark and light in your storytelling, is that something that you consciously take care to do when you're writing the books?
That's a really interesting question because it's hard to know whether it's conscious or whether that's just my particular worldview and my experience of life. I generally think that even in the darkest moments, there is humour. So one of the darkest periods that I've been through in the last 5 years was the passing of my father-in-law. And we were with him in the days before he died, and it was incredibly difficult. But there were also moments of great humour and joy because I don't want to go into too much detail because some of those things that happened towards the end were quite intimate. But, gosh, there were some moments where we laughed and that still make me giggle. But I just think that's life. Life serves up the good and the bad often at the same time. And I think if a day passes where I haven't had a smile or a laugh at least at something, that is a really unusual day for me. So I think part of it's subconscious, but I am also aware that the humour is part of my writing style and part of who I am. I think when I first started writing, I was so consciously trying to be dark and serious and literary all the time, and I wasn't getting anywhere with getting a book published. And it was finally when I allowed the humour to flow through that I got a book deal and wrote After the Party. So, it's all connected. Me finding my natural voice is connected to that theme in The Truth About Faking It, about women finding their own natural voices. And we should never have to apologise. I mean, I know some people perhaps turn their noses up at, so-called light fiction. But to me, humour is fundamental to my sense of self and my mental health and well-being.
We were talking a little bit about, or you were talking a little bit about Ellen before, and the fact that she thinks she's so fabulous and the star of her own Ellen show. I mean, she is one heck of a funny character. I mean, she is the most delightful. If everyone could have her sass and zest for life at that age, at the age of 69, my gosh, the world would be one funny place. Now, some of the things that she said had me absolutely choking with laughter. I mean, that scene on the boat was just it was just classic. She could be sharp-tongued and downright mean sometimes, but she also had an incredibly tender side. Such a complex character in so many ways. Was Ellen based on someone you know, or was she, or is she someone to aspire to, perhaps?
Ellen is probably the woman I want to be when I'm 69. So writing Ellen was a huge amount of fun. It's interesting. So at the moment, I've given my mother an early copy of The Truth About Faking It. And I've said to her, read this book, but please know that you are not Ellen, because my mother and Ellen share a stark similarity in their activities. So my mum does Zumba, Ellen does Zumba. My mum plays bridge, Ellen plays bridge. My mum does not do life drawing. So there are some distinct differences. So, look, I think with all characters that you write, there's an adage that they are one third someone you know, they're one third based on your imagination, and they're one third you. And I think that's exactly what Ellen is. She's probably the woman I want to be. She's probably the woman I see around me. And she's also just a complete figment of my imagination. But I definitely wanted to rewrite the rule book on presenting an older woman just as a sweet, old, slightly technologically incompetent woman. Ellen is a little bit technologically incompetent, true, but she's tremendously competent and a real force of nature in all other areas of her life. She's not a sweet little old grandma. She is a vibrant, vital woman, and she is raging against the dying of the light. She is not going to become invisible in this world that wants to make her invisible. So yeah, I had a huge amount of fun giving Ellen some truly spurious comments and things to say.
Oh, I absolutely loved it. As we already talked about, there were many serious themes in this book, not the least of which, as you mentioned, was the way older women are treated in and by the media, but also the way the media machine can and does exploit women and perhaps vulnerable women for ratings. Tell me about that and why you wanted to explore that issue in this book.
I mentioned earlier Grace Tame, and it's impossible to understate just how much impact she has had on me, and I think that she has had on society in general. I was watching the Australia Day ceremony where she became Australian of the Year and just cried, just couldn't believe what I was hearing from her, what she had suffered. So I think everyone is probably familiar with what happened to her, but she spoke just so honestly about how she'd been groomed by her teacher, how she had been assaulted in her uniform on the floor of his office. That kind of detail just floored me. And I'm just in awe of her bravery and the way she continues to challenge our society to talk about these things, which are really difficult to talk about. The really sad thing, I think, with Grace Tame and others like her, though, is the way that some of the media like to tear women down. They like to criticize. Women who have been abused aren't always believed. And we have a real issue with just sitting back and allowing women to speak about their experiences and not cast judgment or suggest doubt. There's also a real issue that sometimes women's experiences are exploited for ratings, for clickbait. Grace Tame has said that she has been misquoted. She's been treated appallingly by some in the media, which to me is shocking. I mean, the woman went through so much trauma when she was a child, that I fear that by going public, she's re-traumatized herself, not of her own doing, but just by some of the commentary that has swirled around her. So I think we have to be really careful with the way that we listen to survivors of sexual assault and abuse. And we have to be so careful that it's not exploitative, and we have to allow abuse survivors to feel empowered when they speak publicly about what's happened to them. So I think that's something I really did try to inject into the book. What are the ethics for the media around sharing these sorts of stories?
I thought you did that so incredibly well through Natasha and her experiences in this book. I wanted to talk a little bit about Natasha and her daughter, Georgie. Now, both of them enjoy careers in the media, but their areas of interest could not have been any more different. I mean, Natasha being a news anchor at a, you know, serious current affairs program, and Georgie is a producer of a reality TV dating show. Now, Natasha is quite dismissive of her daughter's career, isn't she?
Very. Natasha is just all about news and hard news and serious global events. And I suppose she sees Georgie's career choice as a backlash to her. She takes it quite personally. And I think, you know, part of me did that from a purely functional reason as a writer, in that it sets up a great conflict between mother and daughter. But look, isn't it always the case that daughters like to rebel a little bit against their mothers? So, you know, I think Georgie defends her choice of career because what feminists have been fighting for is for freedom of choice. You know, I choose my choice, and my choice is valid. Just because my mom thinks reality dating is a piece of crap, I don't care. Love matters, and I enjoy my job, and it's fun. So, you know, Natasha, who considers herself a feminist, has to swallow a few of these criticisms because her daughter is a fierce, independent young woman, and this is the job she has chosen, and this is what she wants to do and what she believes in. So, that sort of conflict is just great fodder in fiction.
Speaking of Georgie's choice, and having, to my mortification, succumbed to watching shows like The Bachelor and Maths in the past, I can completely imagine that, you know, what Georgie's experiences was, what goes on behind the scenes of these reality shows, is very much the way you portrayed it through Georgie's story. But what I wanted to know was, what research did you have to bring those experiences to the page?
Clean. It was so hard. I just had to watch 10 seasons of Bachelor and, you know, 3 seasons of Maths. Oh my God. No, actually. I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with reality television. I have watched a fair dose of it in my time. But what I've noticed over time is that it's just become so emotionally manipulative. So I was writing about this yesterday. It's exactly 30 years since the first reality TV show hit our screens, and it was Sylvania Waters. And it was a fly-on-the-wall documentary-style series about a very Aussie, in inverted quotes, family that lived in Sylvania Waters. They were sort of new rich, but they were just appalling human beings. And this was screened first in 1992, and it was a ratings smash. Everyone talked about it. This was pre-social media. So just, it was word of mouth success. And I had a quick look at some episodes of it yesterday, and I was just shocked by how natural and real it felt. No one was wearing makeup. There was probably only one camera in the room. And these people were just saying the most appalling things. And it all seemed to be relatively unedited and unfiltered. Now, contrast that to what we know of reality of today. And it is so highly produced, highly edited, highly stylized that, you know, it's anything but real. I mean, it's totally unreal, if anything. And so, yeah, I did do some research. I read this amazing book called Bachelor Nation, and it was written by an LA Times journalist, Amy Kaufman, and she really dug deep and spoke to some of the insiders who were there at the beginning, at the start of the American version of The Bachelor. And some of the stories are pretty awful. So, you know, they deliberately would ply the contestants with alcohol to amp up the drama. I don't know that that happens anymore, because I think our thinking and understanding of those matters has evolved substantially. The producers would be offered cash incentives to get like the first kiss or the first tears or even the first vomit. And the producers are always really encouraged to get in tight with their contestants. And so that fosters an intimacy so that when they interview them on camera, the contestant's likely to spill their guts. They also use other strategies like cutting them off completely from the outside world so that it does become a pressure cooker atmosphere where the only thing to talk about and obsess over is the man or the woman who's the focus of the competition. And then another interesting tidbit she shared, which is that if a producer wants to get tears out of a contestant, they show kindness. So you say, oh, come in here for a hug, or, you know, let's, you know, that must be really hard for you, and that sort of thing. But I think even since that book has been written, the tactics have gone even further. So, you know, contestants who've left the show talk about how they're subjected to the villain edit treatment. So what happens in the Bachelor house may bear very little resemblance to what we actually see on television, because they can just mash up one tiny bit of an interview with another tiny bit of an interview, put them together, and you just get a completely different meaning. So look, I'd have to say my love affair with reality is dying, because it's not what I signed up for. There's no sincerity to it. I don't feel like I'm learning anything from it anymore. All I feel I'm learning is about the worst aspects of human nature. And that's not how the genre began. It really did begin as average people being subjected to extraordinary situations. These days, the contestants are so savvy. They know what's in it for them. They're exploiting that opportunity. They want the nightclub appearances. They want the extra Instagram followers. They work with the paparazzi to set up those candid shots. They split profits from the photos. They just know what to get out of it. And even worse is that now we have celebrities signing up for these shows, and it's become sort of a pathway to redemption. So if you've committed a crime, if you're a drug dealer, if you've assaulted your partner in the past, go on SAS Australia and you get the opportunity to apologise and share your sob story and win Australia's approval, I suppose. Like, it just... I'm sorry, I'm totally ranting here, but I do have quite strong feelings about just where it's all gone wrong, I suppose.
I don't think you're alone in that regard, Cass, and I completely agree with you that reality television is more about manipulation of the audience than it is about, you know, necessarily just entertainment or, you know, a fly on the wall kind of interest in other people's lives. It's definitely become a big business. And I too question the morality and the ethics of putting known criminals on television and making even bigger stars out of them.
Yes, I'm glad that you share that view, because I'm sure there's probably people out there who would just say, look, just chill out, ladies. It's a telly show. It's just entertainment. But it's not for these celebrities. It's a vehicle to redemption, to getting jobs, to getting further sponsorships. And is that morally or ethically right? I don't know. Does everyone deserve a second chance? I don't know. Is going on SAS the way to do it? Again, I'm not really sure. But as an audience member, I do resent feeling manipulated into feeling sorry for these people, I suppose.
know, I completely understand where you're coming from in relation to reality TV. And thank you for sharing your research process on that. Now, I'm not sure that we can talk necessarily about Natasha's personal demons without giving away spoilers, but suffice it to say that the death of her father, combined with the pressures that she's experiencing at work, combined to bring her to breaking point. And the fact that she's unable to tell her boss about her father's death or why she has concerns about doing that big interview that she's pegged to do says a lot about the way society can portray people who suffer from trauma, doesn't it?
Yes. So Natasha does suffer quite a significant personal trauma that she's not really willing to admit to or own up to. And in similar ways, her dad, I can't really say a lot because it does tend to spoil the book, but definitely I did do a fair bit of research into PTSD and the different ways that it can manifest both bodily and mentally. Within my own inner circle, I have had an indirect experience of a person who has suffered, I suppose, in a sort of similar way to a thing that Natasha has experienced as well. So I do have a little bit of personal insight as to what it's like when a person has suffered a past trauma and that trauma resurfaces. And it can be a really confusing time, especially if you're talking about something from decades ago, because there are issues around not the fallibility of memory. I wouldn't say it's that, because if something traumatic has happened to you in your past, somewhere in your body, I believe that memory is stored, and at some point that memory will resurface. But when I think of myself as a child, the way my memory works is that it's very fragmentary. So I'll remember images or just certain flashes, I suppose. Your memories from decades ago, it's not like watching a linear videotape, I suppose. So when trauma resurfaces, it can be a really confusing time for the person who suffered it, but also for those people around that person as well. So that was definitely something I wanted to explore in the book. I also, you know, David is a journalist and he's a foreign correspondent, and there are some quite well-documented cases of Australian journalists like Philip Williams, who was an ABC correspondent for a long time, and Sally Sara, who is also still works with the ABC and has written a play about the PTSD that she suffered after working overseas. So I definitely researched a few different journalists, also people who had suffered from abuse or assault earlier in their lives. Yeah.
So I know that you're extremely disciplined with your writing, and you've probably already submitted your next book to your publisher. So I wanted to know if there was anything you could tell us about that, or perhaps give us a sneak peek into what you're working on now.
Yes. So because I had that year gap from publishing a book, I am a book ahead. So last year I submitted another manuscript to the publisher. I'm never quite sure how much I'm supposed to say, but look, I'm happy to share that it has a working title of Weekend at Bear Park. And the concept is that it's about a mother's group who go on a weekend away to a resort, but it's a clothing optional resort. And things definitely go terribly badly, but it's not just related to the clothes optional aspect. Something really big happens. And so, yeah, that's what that's about. And so since then, I've now moved on to the next manuscript, which I was trying to write last year during much of the lockdown. And so is in a total mess because my head was in a total mess last year as well.
COVID and creativity during COVID was something that I wanted to talk about. And you were homeschooling three children during COVID lockdown. Despite what you say about your head being everywhere, it does appear that it didn't affect your writing output. You know, that you still are a manuscript ahead, a book ahead. So I wanted to know, I guess, and listeners probably want to know, how you manage that, how you manage your writing with other aspects of your life.
First of all, I'm married to an excellent man who's prepared to share a lot of the duties with me. I'm not going to say I'm lucky, because he's lucky too.
Amen.
You know, and why shouldn't we expect men to do 50% of the work around the house? But I am aware that that's like, that not everyone lives in that sort of situation. So what happened last year is that my husband and I were at home during the lockdown period, and we have three daughters. One of them was totally self-sufficient and didn't need our help because she's in high school. The two little ones in primary did need our help. So we divided and conquered. So my husband looked after one child, I looked after the other child. And luckily, the child I had was the kind who would wake up at 7 a.m. and get straight into her work and try and finish it all by 9 a.m., which was useful for me, but perhaps not the best learning experience for her, because she would just race through and not care what was, you know, what her output was like. And if I would suggest changes and improvements, she would strongly resist. So in the end, I just gave up. And so look, during a non-COVID period, I would normally be able to write about 1,700 to 2,000 words a day. During COVID, I slashed my target. If I got 1,000 words done, I was very happy with that. Basically, I just had to lower the expectation level and just accept that this was the situation. And I hoped that it wouldn't last forever. But even now, I feel like, oh, look, having just had another week in isolation, I'm loath to say we're getting back to normal, but, you know, there is a growing sense of normality. The tricky thing was, and I talked about it earlier, was just that when you're writing a book, it takes so much of your brain space. You know, I can barely cope with just writing the book and managing the lives of my family. That's about as much as my little brain can cope with. So when you throw in a pandemic on top, there just literally wasn't the bandwidth to do it all. So it felt like every word was crap and that what I was writing was total rubbish. But you know what? Now I have 100,000 plus words to play with. And sure, a lot of them might be total crap and I might throw out half the book. But you know, as that old saying goes, you can't edit a blank page. And maybe I needed just to get all those crap words out so that I could find the new ones. So look, I never want to do it again, but I found a way to be productive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if that makes sense. Yeah. And I guess what I'm hearing is that, you know, we all have to adapt to changing circumstances. And, you know, as you say, sometimes you need to lower your expectations and you need to be kind to yourself and be able to manage all aspects of your life.
Yeah.
And not just focus necessarily on that, you know, that magic number.
I think some words are always better than no words, yeah, even if they don't end up in the final book. No words are ever truly wasted. The thing I discovered was that I certainly wasn't the only one in that situation. There were loads of creatives and other people out there who were similarly crippled. So I think that was consoling to understand as well.
Indeed. Well said. Cass, I wanted to say congratulations on The Truth About Faking It. It was a wonderfully funny, witty, intelligent and incisive look at modern life and the lies we tell ourselves and others. I adored it and I wish you every success with it. Thank you for joining me on Talking Aussie Books today.
Claudine, it really has been such a pleasure. You do ask such insightful questions and you always do the research. So I'm really grateful. Thank you for having me.
That's a wrap, folks. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, please drop me a line via my webpage at claudinetonellis.com via Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Alternatively, consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Until next time, happy reading!